Bevor es gleich weitergeht mit dem On the Way to New Work Podcast, unser Werbepartner für diese Woche ist niemand Geringeres als die Firma Products Up. Products Up ist ein Tool, was ihr kennt, wenn ihr im Marketing unterwegs seid oder wenn ihr viel mit Produktdaten zu tun habt, denn die Jungs und Mädels haben eine Software, wie ihr Produktdaten, egal woher sie kommen, managen könnt. Ob sie aus Excel kommen, aus SAP kommen, wo auch immer her. Auf jeden Fall, was die euch hier anbieten, ganz konkret, damit ihr auch was damit anfangen könnt. Es gibt ein White Paper, das sie euch anbieten. Und zwar dreht es sich bei diesem White Paper darum, wie ihr Facebook-Kampagnen starten könnt und die richtige Zielgruppe findet und dann eben entsprechend den Produktkatalog mit den richtigen Kampagnen pusht. Aber auch, wenn ihr Branding machen wollt. Michael und ich machen ja viel Werbung auf Facebook. Wir nutzen das als Tool. Für mich ist es wahnsinnig wichtig, jede Woche Sachen zu schalten zu den entsprechenden Themen. Insofern werde ich mir das selbst anschauen, denn da kann man einiges lernen. Also, Your Complete Guide to Facebook Dynamic Ads findet ihr gratis for free zum Download unter productsup.io/campaignguide. Also alles auf Englisch und unter dem Link. Viel Spaß beim Lesen und jetzt viel Spaß bei der neuen Folge.
Yeah, welcome to the On the Way to New Work podcast. First time in San Francisco. We have a spectacular view here. And my name is Michael Trautmann, and I'm very, very happy to have Amy Wilkinson as our guest.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
And as this is a live podcast, we can give her a warm round of applause from the beginning. So Amy, maybe we start with you as a person. So how did you get to San Francisco? How went your life up to now? What were the most important episodes before you?
So I was born in Hong Kong. I was raised in and out of Asia, grew up in Seattle. My parents are in Portland, Oregon, so Pacific Northwest on the U.S. side. And then I was a student at Stanford for 7 years. So I have a couple of master's degrees there and an undergrad degree. My career has been pretty international in global business and economics. I started in the U.S. Embassy, Mexico City, as a first job, then created a company that was a cross-border art export business from Mexico back through the Seattle Design Center, sold that to a competitor, worked at J.P. Morgan, and did cross-border mergers and acquisitions to Latin America, United States. There's a lot of European crossover, actually, in the Southern Cone, so did a fair amount of advising between Europe and Brazil and Argentina. And then was at McKinsey, did strategy consulting out of San Francisco and London, and did a White House fellowship. I left McKinsey to be part of what in the U.S. is our top leadership fellowship, and moved to Washington, D.C., and did trade policy. And I worked
in the White House?
Yes. Yeah. I worked directly for the United States Trade Representative. I reported in originally to Bob Zoellick, who became the president then of the World Bank, and a couple trade reps after I was in the W. Bush team and transitioning into the Obama team when we bailed out the banks. That was the too big to fail era. And that became the genesis of me leaving the White House. And I spent 5 years at Harvard doing 200 interviews with the top entrepreneurs to try to figure out the skill set to create and scale a new company. Because in the bailout of the banks period of time, if you looked at the economics data, we had to shore up the financial system. I mean, there's no doubt about the fact that we needed to backstop that as the United States government. But when we started bailing out Detroit and the auto manufacturing, I disagreed with that fundamentally and then took a look at the data, and it's firms less than 5 years old that create the net new jobs in the U.S. So if you want job growth, you want high scale entrepreneurs to grow new businesses. And I went out to study them. So I spent 5 years at Harvard and interviewed 200, figured out the skill set. That's the code of the creator's code, the six skills. And then I came back here. I'm in year four of teaching at Stanford Graduate School of Business.
What a impressive CV, and it sounds as if you are 65, but you are less younger. So,
I'm doing things fast.
Amazing. So, let's go to this this book and the study. So, you said 200 interviews, and people among them like Kevin Plank, founder, CEO of Under Armour, the Airbnb guys. It's Elon Musk. So, how did you manage to get these people for interviews?
So the interesting thing about entrepreneurs, especially people that have been successful, is they want other people to be successful. So if you reach out to them and say, I'm really trying to figure out what the skill set is and I'd like a little bit of your time, and then I'm going to share that knowledge with as many people as I can, the default answer, again, I think this is probably cultural to entrepreneurs and to American entrepreneurs, as the U.S. data said, the answer is yes. If you chase them, so there's a lot of chase in this too. I mean, I spent 5 years, right, at tracking people down, reaching out through friends and friends of friends, finding people at conferences, sending letters, sending emails, making calls, and then going to them. And so I went to Elon at Tesla. I went to Kevin Plank at Under Armour in Baltimore. I went to the Spanx founder, Sarah Blakely, in Atlanta. That's an amazing story of the youngest self-made female billionaire in the U.S. That company is wholly owned by Sarah. She starts Spanx with $5,000. There's no angel or venture money in that. I mean, but you have to go to these people in, and I wanted to go to them too, by the way. You kind of want to see people in their natural habitat and check out what the Tesla factory floor looks like or what the Under Armour campus looks like in Baltimore. So it was just a lot of chase.
And you did it over a time span of 5 years, and the interviews, were they structured all in the same way, or how did you compare them then to each other?
Yes. So it was 5 years from the start of doing the research to the publication of the mm-hmm. book. And I was at Harvard, and for those of you that know Harvard, it's like, yeah, it's a pretty serious academic rigor kind of place. And so I had a grounded theory methodology. I'm trained as a sociologist. I also have an MBA. So this is very much a grounded theory method, looking at a semi-structured interview guide where you go very methodically and ask the same set of questions, some unstructured questions at the end. And then it's a pattern recognition exercise.
Okay.
Where there's more than 10,000 pages of interview transcripts behind a 300-page book. I mean, this is the largest data set right now in the U.S. High-scale founders.
Did you use AI to analyze it?
No, I did it.
You did it on your own. Okay.
Yeah. It might get easier. You know, AI is getting smarter. That's good.
That's cool. So let's just jump right into it. So the first habit or however
skill.
You call it, skill.
Yeah, come on,
it's not
Michael.
Habit, it's skill. Sorry.
Yeah.
Find the gap. Explain. What is it? Find the gap.
Find the gap. So find the gap is about spotting opportunities that other people don't see, and you have to look for a gap, right? There are three patterns by which I believe high-scale entrepreneurs do that, and one is as a sunbird. This is what I'm calling it, and that's the Australian word for a hummingbird. It's very much the concept of picking something up, flying it over, and reapplying it somewhere else. This is a cross-fertilization of ideas. So if you want to find a gap, if you want to see something in the world that other people don't see, you can go into the world looking for a working model. Okay, so an example here is Howard Schultz of Starbucks, right? He does not invent coffee culture. He sees it. He sees it in Italy. He goes to Italy for a conference. He sees that the Italians go from home to the conference, but they all stop at the coffee house. It's the third location,
yeah,
the third place they go.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the basis of Starbucks. I grew up south of Seattle when Starbucks, you know, came into being. And what very few people know is that it was an exact copy-paste at the beginning. He literally had bow tie-clad waiters, opera music, a stand-up bar, white porcelain cups. I mean, that does not go down in Seattle, especially in the grunge scene, which was Kurt Cobain at the time. And, all, you know, it's very casual and Gore-Tex jackets and it rains all the time. And, you know, it's a different culture. So what you have to do is see a working model, pick it up, fly it over, reapply it, do a little twist on it to work in the context in which you want to operate. So that's one way to find a gap. And, you know, you can take things across geographies. You can take things across sectors. There's lots of examples in the book and others. You know, you can pick something up out of medical science and apply it into retail like that. You can take an old idea up to date. And so this is a really cool one, I think. I was at Stanford as a student with the Google founders when they were students. And they took the PageRank library system, the card catalog. I don't know how many people remember card catalogs. Show of hands if you remember card catalog.
I don't know.
Like a few people. That is an old technology applied to the World Wide Web. And at the time, by the way, a lot of people thought search was solved. Alta Vista was in the marketplace before Google came with a better old technology that they applied. So you can look for things that already work, and then you can reapply them into the content. That's one way to find a gap.
Mm-hmm. So what was the most surprising gap you heard over the 200 interviews where you said, wow, this is so cool, such a cool story?
Well, I can give you two answers to that. So Elon Musk is somebody who sees gaps all the time, and he's arguably one of the greatest entrepreneurs of our time. And the way he goes into the world looking for things is by spotting a problem that no one else is solving, right? So this is a different thing to do. Look for the fact that no one's taking life to Mars. Pretty spectacular thing to think about. And so he calls NASA. NASA's not doing it. It can't seem to find anyone. He flies into Russia three times and tries to buy an ICBM missile launcher, and the Russians kind of tangle with him. With the negotiations, he gets really frustrated. He goes to China, this, that. No country has solved that problem, which is making life multiplanetary, as he talks about it. So he basically says, okay, I can reason by first principles and build something from the ground up. This is a different way of spotting an opportunity. And he starts SpaceX in Hawthorne, California. It's definitely this bizarre, wild, crazy, you know, thing that no country is doing. He has brought the manufacturing of a reusable rocket in-house and resupplies the International Space Station at 1/10 the price that NASA did. It's extraordinary. But the way you spot that is this first principles reasoning, which is like physicists do this. Physicists go into the world thinking, hey, what are the basic principles here? What are the axioms? Mathematicians do this. What are the fundamental assumptions? And can I build them from the ground up? And so there's like a pretty spectacular, I don't know who saw even last night in San Francisco. Did you guys see this missile launch that was San Francisco based? I was out for Fleet Week, and we were all looking at the sky and we're like, what is that? And then I came home and read the headlines. Oh yeah, that's Elon Musk launching a missile. It's like, okay. I mean, that's amazing ability to spot something and then build something.
And it's getting even more strange or fascinating. I think in 4 years he will send his first missile to the moon. He sold the first to a Japanese billionaire.
Right.
And this billionaire is inviting, I think, nine musicians, art performers to perform while they're flying around the moon. I mean, this is so crazy.
Yeah, but here's the thing. It's not so crazy because it's happening.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds crazy until you realize that there's a reusable rocket landing back, you know, on a platform. And there's an interesting point here. So when I was talking to Elon about this, he was making this point 5 years ago. If we can make a reusable technology, it's a lot less expensive to explore space. And right now, if you flew between San Francisco and Berlin and you threw away the aircraft every time you did that, it would be very expensive for us to travel. And we wouldn't do it. And that's basically what we've done with rocketry. We have thrown away the rocket. Humans in any country, whatever, we've discarded that technology after we launched it. But if you can make a reusable technology, solve the problem in a different way, we'll be able to explore space at a lot lower price point.
Yeah. Skill number two.
Yeah.
Drive for daylight. Very nice. You could have become a copywriter in an agency. Very nice.
Yeah. Okay, so this is just for you, Michael. So this is the concept, because you were the chief marketing officer of Audi, right? This is, if you're driving a car really fast, you want to look for the light on the horizon. You drive towards the daylight. You don't look at the lines on the pavement or the competitors next to you, and you really don't look in the rearview mirror. So the concept here is, if you're in a fast-moving economy, and we know that, I mean, the global economy and technology-accelerated economy is getting faster and faster. If you want to create something the world hasn't seen, you have to always look towards what you're driving towards. What's your mission? What's your purpose? What's the long horizon view? And business doesn't really do this a lot. Business benchmarks. Hey, what's the progress to date? That's not that helpful if you're building something brand new. There's research out of Northwestern University showing if you're committed to a goal and you look forward, what's to go in front of you, you're 2 to 3 times more likely to complete the goal, right? And so if you're creating, as an entrepreneur, if you're creating something new, just don't think about the ground you've already covered or how hard it's been. Like, think about where you want to go. And so the example is Airbnb, which a lot of people in San Francisco are familiar with this story. The founders are from San Francisco, and they call that the 7-year overnight success story. So a lot of people think Airbnb happened really fast. It did not. So Brian and Joe were roommates here. They're two of the three founders. Nate is the third. But Brian and Joe got a little note under their door that said, your rent is up 25%. And they were out of the Rhode Island School of Design and didn't have a lot of money and couldn't pay that kind of an increase in their rent. And so there was also a conference in San Francisco at the same time, and all the hotels were sold out, a conference for designers. So they put this notice up that said, hey, if you're a designer and you need a place to stay, we have some air mattresses, and we'll put a little mint on your pillow, and we'll pick you up at the airport, and we'll make you some breakfast. We'll show you around our city. We'll try to make it really nice for you. You could pay us something. Maybe we could try to make our rent. And that's the genesis of the concept, but nobody backs it. It's a weird, creepy idea. I mean, at the beginning, having a stranger sleep in your house when you're there, or having somebody sleep in your house when you're not there, like when they begin that sharing economy concept, it's really not grabbing on. And so they keep driving for daylight. They keep, you know, looking forward. They launch and they relaunch. There's a lot of, they're really funny about it. Obviously, they're huge now globally. Any given night around the world, there are more people staying in Airbnb housing than any other major hotel chain now. That's not how it starts. And they launch even at South by Southwest, which for us is this big tech conference in Austin, Texas.
Many Germans use Airbnb when they're there.
Yeah. Okay, well, so that's perfect because Twitter launched there. Airbnb came up after Twitter, and they thought, oh, we're going to have a Twitter moment. It's going to be just great, like South by Southwest style. Three people used Airbnb, and Joe and Brian were two of the three. They're like, whoa, that did not work. I mean, so they're funny about that. They're like, well, okay, we'll launch again. Like, if nobody pays attention, we'll just launch and relaunch and launch and relaunch. And so that's the concept behind, like, having this long-term purpose and then just navigating around obstacles.
Yeah. Next is very fine as well. Fly the OODA loop. It's an old concept from a pilot.
Correct.
Yeah. Maybe
OODA.
Explain it. Yeah. OODA.
Yeah. Hmm? So it's OODA, stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, Act. And it's a fighter pilot framework originally. I spent 10 years living out of Washington, D.C., and so I was with some military people in the White House Fellowship, especially. And the Air Force, for the United States, is that we've had supreme air power. We've not had the best equipment. And this is what people haven't realized. The Russian MiG could fly higher and faster than F-15, 16, 16E, our fighter jets. And the reason why the United States could dominate was that we taught pilots to observe, orient, decide, and act. We taught them to move through the transitions faster. And so this applied to an entrepreneurial economy is observe things that other people dismiss, orient very quickly, ask a ton of questions, make a decision, and take an action. And if you make decisions and keep making good decisions, you can change the dynamics of a fight, because a competitor is responding to an action. You've switched the landscape, even if it's a split second ahead. Right. So that's the concept. And you see lots of, especially technology entrepreneurs, Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. And I can give examples if you want.
But yeah, give me one example. It's cool. Yeah.
So the PayPal mafia, as they're called out here, are the kind of famous Silicon Valley example. They had six different business models in 18 months. So in a year and a half, they moved through six different ideas. They raised capital from Nokia Ventures on idea three, which was beaming cash between handheld devices, and it was the Palm Pilot. This is in 1999, a long time ago, to have that kind of a supreme technology. I mean, they really built a beautiful technology, and no one cared. Okay, there's
the
surprise.
They had a hell of money. They had lots of money.
They had some money, and they had this like beautiful way to exchange money. But everyone started using the demo support site online. This makes no sense if you think you're beaming cash, right? But they observed that and said, all right, let's orient, decide, and act. Let's make an online currency where people can email cash back and forth. That becomes PayPal as we know it. eBay has got auctions, buying and selling at that time. And some eBay users are trying to use the PayPal demo website. And they think that is so much of a distraction. I mean, Max Levchin, who's the chief technology officer, basically says, go away, eBay users, like, get out of here. And then they have this epiphany. They observe, orient, decide, act. They're like, that is fabulous, because that's the massive volume of people that will use our online product if we build it. So PayPal builds this, you know, way to exchange for buyers and sellers of eBay auctions. eBay buys a competitor called BillPoint. eBay has a lot of money, a lot of resources, a lot of people. They never can keep up because the decision cycle is so much faster at this startup. Another thing that happens is that Visa, the credit card company, presses litigation against the startup and basically says, now you're getting into our world. Like, now you're operating like a credit card. And the PayPal team of 15 people deploys. Reid Hoffman goes out to talk to them and basically says, oh, please drop your lawsuit. Okay. I don't know how many of you guys have convinced someone to drop a lawsuit. The answer is no. And so Reid basically convinces them to buy time. Oh, why don't you just study this sector for 12 months? Let's study what this looks like. Because, you know, like the whole thing, we're not a credit card company, but, you know, like, well, let's study the problem. Okay. Visa studies the problem while PayPal moves through the OODA loop. They observe, orient, decide, act. They keep moving. Visa's studying this thing. The answer here is never study the problem. Just act, right? Because PayPal goes public, then sells to eBay ahead of when the tech bubble burst in 2002. So the winning strategy is keep moving. The much more interesting thing is what happens next. And that's that the original team of PayPal basically fans out and starts the entire next wave of the internet. So they start LinkedIn, YouTube, Yelp, Yammer, which sells to Microsoft, Palantir is in the marketplace now. It's obviously Elon's companies, Tesla, SpaceX. They put the first investment behind Mark Zuckerberg for Facebook. They generate the next wave. And so for this book and research set, I spent time with all of them asking, how do you not just do that once, but how do you go out and do it as individuals over and over again, right? And what they'll say in different words, like Jeremy Stoppelman, the founding CEO of Yelp, will say, it's a counterintuitive blip of data. Look for that. That's a quote in this book. Like, mm-hmm. Look for something counterintuitive, and it's going to be small. It's going to look like a blip, and it's going to be data-based. And follow that. So if there's a surprise in the result that you see, pay a lot of attention. And Yelp was built as an email referral system, not a review site. They had this tiny little feature that said, do you want to write a review? And the founding team did not think that would be fun. They were like, nobody cares about writing reviews of beauty salons or nail salons or restaurants or dry cleaners, whatever. And that's the big surprise. Like, that was the thing that got traction. So they built it, became a review site. YouTube was started as a video dating site. Okay, so that was supposed to be about dating. It was right on the tail of, are you hot or not? This was like kind of a slimy idea for website dating. But they were shooting video at a zoo. And they put up an elephant video just as beta testing. We're just testing video, trying to make sure that it works, that we can upload and this and that. And everybody starts watching the elephant video and then the animal video. And they're like, okay, this does not make sense if you're doing a dating site. And then obviously it gets opened up. I mean, YouTube is the all things video site. So, you know, there are multiple examples here, but the point to learn is be alert.
Yeah.
If you see a glitch, if you see a counterintuitive, you know, especially piece of data, jump on it, go for it. Probe, ask questions, orient to it, make decisions, take actions, like don't dismiss it. Because the vast majority of people are in a routine and they simply dismiss the kind of, you know, anomaly that you might see out there. Mm.
Which perfectly fits to skill number four, fail wisely. So it's really, yeah. I think you have to be humble and to really do it if it's necessary and not say, oh, failing is something bad. Maybe you...
Well, so I should ask you about this. So how do Germans think about failing?
Oh, I think in Germany, failing is something which is not good. An entrepreneur who fails is not seen as a good entrepreneur. I think in the US it's the opposite. If someone fails, wow, he has experiences, we should give him money again because he's not doing the same mistakes again. And I think there is research which shows that an entrepreneur who failed once is more successful in average than all entrepreneurs. And this research, maybe in Germany as well, the same, but in Germany it's a problem if you fail.
Yeah. So I want to start this by saying all failure is not equal. This is a really important idea. And failing wisely is the skill. You want to be smart about testing, experimenting, failing, learning, and growing through. So to your point, if you're an entrepreneur who's failed, the assumption in Silicon Valley is largely, oh, you learned something, you're more knowledgeable, you will take that information, and you're not going to make that mistake again. Okay, failing stupidly would be to continue to fail in the same way. Like, if you continue to do the same thing, and you're not learning, and you're not changing, you're just repeating that error, nobody's going to give you chance 2, 3, 4, and 5. Right. If you are learning, that's the really important thing here. If you're learning and getting smarter every single time, you're wise about what you're doing, that's just called getting more experience in creating something the world hasn't yet seen. And so the concept about failing wisely is about a ratio. And I believe that really great entrepreneurs set a ratio before they start, which says, you know, 1 in 3 things I try is not going to work. 1 in 10 things I try is not going to work. 1 in 5. I mean, whatever your ratio is for your risk appetite, you set it at the beginning and you say, that's actually what I want, which is 1 in 5 things I try is going to be brand new and innovative and it's not going to work. And great, because if I have a 0 ratio, that means I have a perfect record. And that basically means I've done nothing new. Because you cannot create something new in a perfect way. And so there are multiple examples of this. Even big companies out here, Google's got a ratio of 70-20-10. And that's for management time. By the way, 70% of time should be on core business, 20% of time should be on side business related, 10% of time should be on moonshots, crazy wild ideas, right? And this is not the engineering, you know, 10% rule. This is the management, senior executive team, like 70-20-10. This is how you should divvy up your focus. Again, that's not looking like a perfect record. There's definitely a fail wisely concept in there. So that's basically what it is. Or another way to talk about it is if I give you $100, make 10 $10 bets. If 3 of them don't work, that's probably okay. You know, if 7 of them work, you're really moving forward. If you shoot everything on $100, I give you $100 bill and you shoot it all in one hit, it's a lot harder. That might be considered failing catastrophically. But if you fail incrementally, that's a pretty smart way to do it.
Bevor es weitergeht, hier noch unser Werbepartner Persil Service Online. Ein Zusammenschluss aus einem 150 Jahre alten Reinigungsfranchise und dem Erfinder von Persil, der Henkel AG. Und warum ist das Ganze so spannend? Ihr findet unter der Domain geschickt-gereinigt.de die Möglichkeit, euren Abholservice als Versandreinigung zu nutzen. Also, ihr bekommt einen Karton, packt alles rein, was ihr gereinigt haben möchtet und habt die Möglichkeit, es dann einfach wieder zurückzubekommen. Und in der Zwischenzeit könnt ihr ganz entspannt Kaffee trinken, denn ihr habt nichts zu tun, außer abzuwarten. Großartig. Ich bin nie ein Fan von Reinigung gewesen. Insofern Reinigung zu Hause wohlgemerkt. Insofern, das wäre mein Service gewesen. Und ihr habt hier die Möglichkeit, auf etwas zuzugreifen, was ihr mit normaler Reinigung nicht schafft. Durch den Zentralservice ist die Qualität enorm hoch und ihr könnt eben auch sehr sensible Sachen mit reingeben. Großartig, meldet euch an, probiert es aus. Ihr habt die Möglichkeit, einen 15-Euro-Gutschein zu bekommen. Momentan läuft ein Gewinnspiel, wo jeder 100. Kunde eine Nespresso-Maschine gewinnt, eben Kaffee trinken statt Wäsche waschen. Das Angebot läuft noch bis zum 26. Oktober. Registriert euch mit einmal dem kostenfreien Waschkarton. Insofern viel Spaß bei geschickt-gereinigt.de.
Network Minds.
Wait, what is that?
That's your number five.
That network, is number five.
Network Minds. Yeah.
Okay. So,
I strong belief in this concept of networking. Yeah.
Yeah. So this concept is around harnessing the brain power of other people to solve problems in new ways. So if you network the minds of people who think differently from you, that's how you're able to build on each other's ideas and come up with something original. And this is really about cognitive diversity. So we talk a lot about diversity that you can see on the outside, race, gender, socioeconomic differences. My research set shows that it doesn't matter that much what you look like on the outside. It matters what your brain power is on the inside and how you will bring that to other people and contribute a point of view. So, for example, you can be trained as a computer scientist. You can be trained as an anthropologist. Totally different cognitive diversity coming there. You can be an extrovert. You can be an introvert. Different way of seeing the world. You can be a convergent thinker. You can be a divergent thinker. Some of this is informed by the way you were raised or you know, the way you grew up. A lot of it is that people just have different points of view. They have different cognitive abilities. And so it takes a while to talk to people and find out, are they going to be able to build on a point of view? Are we going to be able to solve a problem in a new and different way? And often this feels uncomfortable to people. Entrepreneurs are pretty good at it when you think about it. You know, you need the technology person and the business person. You need the operator. You need the marketer. You need the agency person. I mean, you need all of these different backgrounds in order to move a business forward. But there's quite a lot of research that shows we like people who are similar to ourselves. Yeah, we like people who look like us, who are trained like us, who came from the universities that we went to, that came from the hometown we grew up in, whatever. And that is actually not very good for entrepreneurship. You want very divergent points of view. There's a study that I find really interesting that's in this book as well that shows if you try to solve a problem as an individual, your solve rate is about 44%. Okay, so even super bright people with a lot of brain power, you apply your brain power towards, you know, solving really complex problems, and you get it right maybe 44% of the time. If you bring other like-minded people that are trained similarly to you, that look like you, that grew up in the same place,
do the same sport.
Yeah, exactly, that have the same skill set, basically, your solve rate goes up to 55%. Gets a little better when you get other people to help you. When you bring in a diverse person, very much dissimilar from the way that your small group is trying to solve a problem, your solve rate goes up to 75%.
Wow.
Okay, huge difference. But the teams that are having these outsiders in them feel very uncomfortable. So they report that they're less efficient, they feel awkward, they've got social unease in them. You know, they actually don't think they're getting anywhere. They think they're having lots of awkward dialogues about things. But when you look at the solve rate, it's, you know, almost double what somebody would do alone. Now, we think that's because the outsider brought in the nugget of information, right? But what this research shows is that every single person does their homework, comes with their point of view, raises their own performance. If you think you're going to be challenged, you raise your own game. You become better yourself. So that's the reason to bring in a diverse point of view. It's not necessarily that the diverse person solves it. It's that together, all of you solve it. And if you're going to be challenged, you're more likely to be prepared.
Who was best in class among your interview partners, where was the best or most diverse team?
That's a pretty good question. you know, I didn't actually look at that. So the research basically informs six skills. I'll give an anecdotal answer, which is, I think one of the best examples is Bob Langer. And he runs the largest biotechnology engineering lab in the world. He runs it out of MIT. He's co-founded 40 companies that have gone over $100 million in revenue in 5 years. He does this with very diverse scientists and business people coming together. This is in Boston to solve problems of human suffering, as he talks about it. So they are building medical technologies and delivery vehicles for cancer-fighting drugs. He's big in the stopping cancer. And human tissue engineering, the idea that we could regrow our own organs on plastic scaffolding, that's coming out of Bob Langer's lab. He's won all three Academy of Sciences Award, the Academy of Engineering. President Obama gave him the Civilian Medal of Honor. Nobody knows his name. And the reason why is because he's not about ego. He's about partnering, networking brain power, supporting other people, a lot of them students through MIT and other collaborative business people that want to commercialize that scientific research just to stop the human suffering that's on the health side. So I think that's one of the best examples that I know of people that really network minds well.
Cool example. So number six, we're coming to number six, gift small goods. So now it's getting a little bit softer. So I like this.
Oh, yeah. You like it?
Yeah. I like it.
Okay, good. A small good is a small kindness. It's something of value. And the idea of gifting this is to be generous, to do small favors for other colleagues, other people that are in the extended workplace. And the concept here is it's a five-minute favor. This is the basis of LinkedIn. So Reid Hoffman built LinkedIn with this in mind. And Reid would say, no one's going to throw themselves in front of a train for you, but people can do a five-minute favor. You know, if you forward a resume, if you write a few lines of code, if you critique a proposal, if you come and do a podcast for an hour, whatever it is, that's a generous act and it helps other people. It costs you very little. And hopefully it contributes to somebody else's success. And the idea with that is in a more transparent world and a more networked world, this makes you more productive. It used to be sort of morally right to be a collaborative person or to help people out. Now, in fact, with a transparent reputation, I can find out something about everyone here very rapidly, and I can find out, are you a good colleague? Do you assist? Are you helping encourage the people that work for you and around you and everything else? If the answer is yes, information comes to you. Deal flow comes to you. People want to work with you. Talent shows up. All these great things happen because of your transparent reputation for assisting people. The opposite is also true, which is if very rapidly in this world of transmitting information, if your reputation is that you hoard resources, that you do not collaborate, you do not share, you cheat, maybe you steal, maybe, you know, you're not a good colleague, we're going to find that out really rapidly as well. It's pretty easy to find someone who's worked with you and reach them on social media of any variety or text message them or, you know, learn a little bit. And so it's very much in your self-interest to be good. And I think that's one of the coolest things about technology is it's putting more pressure on better behavior. And so that's the idea of gifting small goods is it's not only morally right, but it's making you more productive now.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. There's a Adam Grant. You know Adam Grant.
Give and take. I know Adam pretty well. Yeah.
The give and take concept says the same.
That's right.
He says there are givers, takers, and changers. People who are takers, they always want more in a deal than the other one. Givers are always giving without expecting anything back.
Right.
And the interesting thing is that the givers are on the bottom. So if you're giving too much and you see just the other people, you're very unsuccessful. But the most successful people are givers as well. And that's interesting.
So the real important person there. And Adam Grant is at Wharton, but that piece of research is Frank Flynn's research, and he's at Stanford Business School. And so that study that you're mentioning is about engineers, and the most productive people are generously giving, but the difference is they're asking for help as well. Mm-hmm. And so this is this constant interchange. So you need to be gifting small goods and helping people, but you can't be neglecting your own work.
Yeah.
Right? You also need to be saying to people, hey, you know, I see that you have some thing over there that might help me. Can we engage back and forth? And that's exactly right. It's really important to be in the constant give and take.
Cool. Last question to the book. Can you learn these skills or do you have to?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah.
You decoded it so you now can teach them. Is it that what you do in Stanford?
Yes. Yeah. So that's the entire intention to go out and figure this out, is that it would be empowering other people to be creators, right? So that more people would create and scale new concepts. And originally in my purpose of doing this, it's so that we would create more jobs, right, across the U.S. economy and really across the world economy. I believe it's a learnable, teachable, coachable skill set.
Cool. And it's not just for entrepreneurs. As I learned, you are now trying to bring this concept into large organizations.
Right. So, and I know you have a big organization background. So I stood up a company called Ingenuity, and we are advising Fortune 500 businesses, very large global companies, on how to make employees entrepreneurial. And I believe this is the next frontier. So I've spent 10 years now studying high growth founders of new companies. And I'm shifting. I'm right now teaching a brand new course that we're piloting out at Stanford Business School called Beyond Disruption. And we're looking at, isn't there a new paradigm now to be an entrepreneur at scale? Mm-hmm. And I believe that if you really want to move now the global economy, that the frontier looks like being entrepreneurial in large legacy businesses, and that entrepreneurial intelligence together with artificial intelligence is the winning recipe, right? You need to be an entrepreneurial person and you need to be data-based, and that can move at scale. So Ingenuity, our company, is advising big companies on this. My class, we had Philipp Schindler, who's German. He's the chief business officer at Google, in class a couple days ago. Steve Kessel of Amazon came in just before that. Tomorrow we have the head of innovation for Procter & Gamble and Intel, and transformation, head of transformation for Barclays, head of experimental retail for Walmart, et cetera. So I'm bringing in entrepreneurs that are moving organizations at scale and looking at how to do that effectively.
Very nice. And you German companies could use your advice
so.
As well?
Oh, I think so. So I'm actually coming into Berlin on October 20th to participate in the annual meeting for Porsche, which they're doing with the senior leadership team, and have spoken to a number of the big German companies. There's actually quite a lot of appetite, I would say, in Europe and in the automotive sector that I can see, given self-driving vehicles. I mean, I live here and I see Google's self-driving cars, the parking lot for them I drive by every day. I'm like, wow, okay, that's real. Like, it's not the future, it's now. And car sharing, a lot of people who thought, oh, you know, Uber or Lyft or call this anything across the world, Didi, Ola, Grab Taxi. I mean, there's different names for this sharing model. It's happening. And so I think if you are, you know, a German automotive company, there's probably a lot to learn from an entrepreneurial skill set, an entrepreneurial mindset, in order to leapfrog forward. It feels to me like a lot of these businesses, legacy businesses, have the 2025 plan or the 2020 plan, and you know they got to accelerate. They need to get there fast because the world is moving fast. And so yeah. And I guess I'd make one more point about this. In standing up the tools to try to advise big companies, I believe very much it's a micro learning curriculum. So this sounds like this big, huge concept. I think it's every single day you need to practice an entrepreneurial skill set. And so we're building tools to help people do that. And it's the idea, if you want to get stronger, you don't just go to the gym like once a quarter or once a year, you don't just go to an annual meeting for 3 days like you would go to the gym for 3 days. You go every single day and you gradually get stronger, right? So if you want to be more entrepreneurial, I think it's a micro-learning approach to being more entrepreneurial in your daily work.
And will your work will be available in, let's say, e-learning formats like videos, or is it already available?
Yeah, so we're building that out. So we're building out audio, video, lots of different metrics and Myers-Briggs like diagnostic for entrepreneurial skills. So that's what we're doing now. So stay tuned, or if you're interested, I'm easy to find. I mean, I'm just amywilkinson.com.
We will make sure that everyone will find you. Amy, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
For spending the time with us. And all the best for your future, and we will have a look on it.
Well, can I ask you one question before we're done?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're an entrepreneur, right? And you started your own agency. So what do you think it takes to be a successful entrepreneur?
I have to say that this, I'm not through with your book, but I feel very comfortable with your six skills. I'm not good in any in every skill of this, but some of them I think are the reason why I'm quite successful, why I could build an agency with 400 people. It's not the type of entrepreneur you have in your study, but I think it's even for smaller scale businesses, it's true. I feel good with it. So I'm happy that we met, and I will read the book.
All right, and I look forward to your book as it comes out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Set some pressure on me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hier ein kurzer Einspieler zu einer neuen Sportart. Habt ihr den Begriff High Rocks schon mal gehört? Wie ihr alle wisst, Sport ist natürlich bereichernd für Geist und Körper, keine Frage. Nur, was ist die echte Herausforderung? Gibt es ein Ziel? Und was ist das, warum ihr diesen Sport macht? High Rocks liefert die Antwort drauf. Es ist eben eine Mischung aus Fitness und Laufen. Ist für alle, die Lust haben zu trainieren und eben ihre Bestzeiten zu schaffen. Was ihr macht, ihr müsst euch das so vorstellen, das ist wie beim Zirkeltraining damals. Ihr lauft einen Kilometer und absolviert danach immer eine Challenge aus dem Fitnessbereich. Zum Beispiel einen Schlitten für 50 Meter zu schieben oder zu ziehen oder sowas. Insgesamt macht ihr 8 Runden, jeweils 1 Kilometer, gefolgt von diesen Challenges. Das ist der Sport. Es ist extrem krass anzusehen. Michael hat das mit erfunden quasi, sozusagen, wenn man das so sagen kann. Und es ist nicht nur gesund, sondern eben auch für jeden, der wirklich sagt, ich mache gerne Sport. So, ihr habt in einer Pro-Kategorie in dem Sport auch die Möglichkeit, im Double anzutreten, wenn ihr eben wirklich richtig Gas geben wollt. Also, warum erzähle ich das Ganze? Es gibt für alle Early Adopters und für alle Entrepreneurs, die eben loslegen wollen, ein Event. Also, ihr könnt zeigen, was in euch steckt. Geht mal auf HYROX, geschrieben HYROX.com. Und mit dem On the Way to New Work Code, der heißt HYROX-NEW-WORK, gibt es 30% auf den Anmeldepreis, und schaut euch das mal an. Ja, wie gesagt, eine Erfindung von Michael, und reinschauen lohnt sich. Es ist nämlich eine neue Sportart und ziemlich challenging. Ich bin gechallenged worden, insofern ich werde definitiv ein Video dazu drehen mit meiner ersten Runde HYROX.